Stand Up with Pete Dominic. With Pete Dominic. On Indy, Sirius XM 104.
All right, he is here, ladies and gentlemen. It's been 2 weeks since we had a conversation with Dr. Aaron Carroll. And he's here now, so give us a call and join the conversation, 866-994-6343. I know you've got a lot of questions, comments, arguments that you'd like to make for one of the best experts on health insurance, health policy, health care, and the land. He is on Twitter, at Aaron E. Carroll. If you're not following him, you're very, very much missing out. He's a professor of pediatrics, and he's also the director of the Center for Health Policy and Professionalism Research at Indiana University. And he's also an author. He writes books. He co-writes books, Debunking Medical Myths. And the first one is called Don't Swallow Your Gum, Myths Have Truths and Outright Lies About Your Health, Your Body and Your Health. And the sequel is Don't Crush Your Eyes, They'll Get Stuck That Way. He's working on a third one. He also blogs at The Incidental Economist, probably the most popular health care health policy blog on all of the internets, the web world. And also he now does videos, YouTube videos, with YouTube star John Green every week. Most recently, the one was about the myth that sugar makes your kids hyper, which I know a lot of people, our listeners, have seen and commented on. Dr. Aaron Carroll, there you are. There's your introduction.
Thank you.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. Let's talk first about trans fats.
Sure.
Why are trans fats in the news? The FDA has come out with some new... are we banning? Are we outlawing trans fats? What are they? And what's the story about them?
So we're getting close to getting rid of them. So basically that the FDA is looking like they're going to remove their sort of labeling of saying that they're safe. And so if something is not immediately assumed to be safe, then a company has to make a good argument as to why it should be allowed into individual foods on, like, in a case-by-case basis, and no one thinks anyone's going to make this argument about trans fats, so it's effectively getting rid of them in processed foods. But taking 3 steps back, trans fats have been around for a couple decades. They became more and more popular back in a few decades ago when people thought, like, for instance, if you remember back in like the 80s or so, everyone started to get on this push. They thought that margarine was better than butter, that you know, somehow like the processed or vegetable type fats were going to be safer than the animal based fats. And so there was a real push for like margarine versus butter. And so that's trans fats. That is sort of unsaturated fats, and that became more and more popular, and they became to appear more and more in food. They taste better, people like the texture, and they also help food to stick around longer. It keeps on the shelf, the amount of time it can stick around without spoiling, and processed foods are also higher in foods with trans fats. But there's a problem, and that as time went on, more and more evidence started to be shown that these were actually more unhealthy than animal-based fats, because all fats raise your unhealthy cholesterol a bit. And so that's the big concern. You know, you eat too much of this, you get too much bad cholesterol, you get too much LDL, and you start to actually have a significantly higher risk of heart disease. The problem with trans fats is at the same time, they also lower your levels of good cholesterol, or HDL. So trans fats pack this double whammy of not only raising your bad cholesterol, but lowering your good cholesterol. And it started to be seen that in good studies, people who ate more trans fats were actually even faring worse than people who ate more saturated fats. And so these things were actually more and more unhealthy and started to be a real problem for people with respect to actually dying of heart disease. So, you know, these are in a ton of processed foods. They were in sort of all fast foods. They were in tons of foods that were made. They were in the foods that we serve kids. They're all over the place. They were ubiquitous, and there started to become this uproar. So many companies, to their credit, started voluntarily getting rid of these things. McDonald's no longer uses trans fats and hasn't, I think, for a decade in any of its food. Burger King has a tiny amount of trans fats left in their food, but they're sort of very rare naturally occurring trans fats. Same is true for KFC, lots of companies. So about 75% of foods have already eliminated trans fats voluntarily. That's how bad these things are. And, you know, so this was already happening, but they were still left in some processed foods, again, especially in the stuff that we serve kids, because kids get a ton of processed foods, even as part of school lunches. And so You know, think microwave popcorn. Think all kinds of stuff where there might be a food that you buy and a package that's going to have some fat in it. It's going to have these very, very unhealthy fats. It's important to know that the vast, vast, vast majority of trans fats, which are used in like foods like this, they're made in a lab. These are not naturally occurring things that your body requires. This is not the same as sugar or protein or anything else. They are specifically made, and the body doesn't need them. And so the FDA finally sort of got around to saying, you know what? There's no good reason to have these things around anymore. They significantly increase the risk of heart disease, and they're a real problem, and they're not natural, and they're already on their way to going out. We're going to finally pass the rule. So what they did was they passed this preliminary rule, which gives companies and the public a couple months, I think, to voice their complaints and to voice their concerns and to talk about how we can best go about eliminating them. If you want my gut opinion, I don't think the companies are going to fight this. This is a losing battle.
All right. Well,
I think when they come back to this, they're going to go.
All right. Let me just one comment on this, because I think the debate about it is a bit absurd, but let me try to push back as best I can. You said that they're not natural and our body doesn't need them. Well, nor are a lot of things that are unhealthy to ingest. Many things,
like
you
what?
Could say.
Like unsweetened stuff, I'm going to go crazy. Go ahead.
No, like alcohol.
Okay, that's a fair point. Alcohol, but except
like
for the
cigarettes.
Fact that alcohol, first of all, is completely natural. You don't need the lab to make it. In fact, you can make it, you know, quite easily. It occurs in nature, and it has been around forever. I don't disagree. But alcohol is not a food.
Cigarettes.
Again, cigarettes are not a food. If somebody wants
ice cream.
If somebody wants to make a trans fat that you can use.
Pancakes.
Stop.
Pancakes.
Pancakes, first of all, are just taking regular ingredients and putting together them in an unhealthy way. That is very different than creating a substance in a lab and slipping it into tons and tons of processed foods and then giving it out to people, when you could make do with other things which are pretty good and also just, you know, unhealthy but not as unhealthy.
Well, I'm with Rand Paul. The government is coming for your donuts. That is the quote Rand Paul told a room full of conservatives in South Carolina Monday, accusing the FDA of launching a campaign of donut obliteration, according to Mother Jones, Aswan, Subasang. Let me finish.
Okay.
He said, did you hear they're coming after the trans fat in your donuts? The senator was referring to the FDA's decision last week to have the food industry phase out trans fat. He said, I say we need to line every one of them up. I want to see how skinny or how fat the FDA agents that are making the rules on this, because if they're going to have a nanny state and everybody's got to eat the right thing and you can't eat a donut, maybe you got to just enforce it on government workers first. And then if I go over to the Free Republic, which is a right-wing website, they are saying that where does government get the raw power to ban trans fats or any other substance that Americans voluntarily and peacefully ingest?
Okay, first of all, I don't think I don't think tons of people know, but let's own that we draw a line in the sand. We don't let stuff in. We don't put arsenic in the food. We don't allow arsenic in the food. We don't slip it in and tell people that, you know, they should just know better and make a choice. And anyone who eats the arsenic and dies, well, that's on them. We all agree that that's not good. So why? Because it kills you. If we had, you know, other stuff that winds up increasing the risk of cancer, or then we mandate that shouldn't be in the food either, and no one says a word. So there is a line. The question is, where do you put that line? No one's banning donuts. Donuts existed long before trans fats. Donuts will exist long after trans fats. Donuts have been around for a long, long time. And donuts exist today without trans fats. We're eliminating an artificial nutrient, or I shouldn't even say nutrient, an artificial substance which was invented because people thought it was going to be better. It turns out it's not. That it turns out significantly increases your chance for heart disease. What makes me angry about this is that I think if this thing caused cancer, no one would say a word. I think I wrote a piece on this. If we had a substance which significantly increased the risk of breast cancer, and it turned out that it was giving significantly more women breast cancer, and we were putting this in the food that we serve children, and although 75% of foods had already eliminated it, it still existed, and it was significantly raising the risk of breast cancer, no one would debate this. Everybody would be like, get rid of it tomorrow. But the fact that it causes heart disease gets a weird pass in this country. Somehow it's like, well, that's a lifestyle choice. Heart disease kills like 6 times as many women as breast cancer does. Heart disease kills more people in the United States than all cancers plus HIV combined. You know, heart disease is the scourge that is killing more people than almost anything else in the United States. And we give this thing a pass. Somehow it's like, oh, that's a lifestyle choice, and that's okay. So we do, I mean, for Rand Paul to stand up and be like, the government can't make any decisions about that is insane, unless he wants to take, you know, Russian roulette that they could put poison in his food and just tell him, well, it's his choice, he should just know better. So we do get rid of things. This is one which, again, it's not a nutrient. It is not regulating what you eat. It is saying don't put this thing that causes heart disease into processed foods. If people want to go and find trans fats as they occur in nature, feel free. They still do exist. They're not being banned in the sense that that they will be running around trying to find every last scrap of this stuff. It's not like it exists. It's not like it's around. Tobacco, for all we hate it, grows outside. You know, alcohol, you can make it if you just put a couple ingredients together and just leave it sitting around outside. Trans fats are not like that. Not only that, trans fats are, a food stuff. Tobacco is not a food stuff, and they are not.
What are the 2 most popular donut chains in America?
Ooh, I would guess Dunkin' Donuts and Krispy Kreme.
Both Dunkin' Donuts and Krispy Kreme, you're correct. Actually, I don't know if you're right. Okay. But both of those companies have already eliminated trans fats.
This is what I mean. This is why it's such a joke and why it's like I can't believe that people say they're coming for your donut. No, Krispy Kreme and Dunkin' Donuts already don't have trans fats in them. You know, this is truly, I think they're just tilting at windmills at this point. It's like, you know, you want to fight.
I do have it.
Feel free.
Actually, we do know now that Rand Paul stole all of the quotes from Wikipedia that he said about trans fats. So.
Is that – was those – okay, you're making a joke, I hope.
Yeah,
those
I made
the
a joke.
Stole?
It was a terrible joke.
Mark in Massachusetts. No, but I had me fooled for a second because I thought maybe that's where he stole the jokes about this. That'd be funny.
Mark in Massachusetts, you're on with Dr. Aaron Carroll.
Hi, Aaron and Pete. I think – you have to have like a chemistry guy on, but I think the – trans fat is just like a cheap industrial replacement for basically butter. So your food might actually taste better if you made them actually make it with butter. I talked to a chef about this.
It's totally possible. I think there are some people that think that, like, I actually read a few food experts that were trying to make, I mean, not to make an argument, but trying to explain that, you know, trans fats, you know, besides making the food last longer on the shelf, it just has a different feel in the mouth, they were saying. In other words, it's like sometimes it's this ineffable quality of, like, it makes some processed foods taste or feel slightly different. And they said companies are probably going to have to find fixes, you know, just figure out another way to make it feel like that and figure out another way to make it taste like that. But, again, it's Krispy Kreme donut is not as if Rand Paul went on a rampage years ago when Krispy Kreme voluntarily got rid of their trans fats and said, now these things taste like death. You know, they taste awesome, even with the regular old saturated fat stick in them. And so, you know, most McDonald's has not had this stuff for a decade. This is a fight. Yeah, this is not a fight. I can't imagine people are deciding this is where they want to fight, because you're fighting for a thing that's already been eliminated from most of the unhealthy food in this country. No one noticed the difference. This is not the battle to have. I'm sort of baffled by it.
Well, we spent too much time on it already, but I wanted to educate people on that before
so
Rand Paul got up. Yeah. Well, no, it is fascinating. It's more fascinating than we're going to talk about Obamacare. That's for sure. But it's and it is important. But listen, let's get to some phone calls and some questions here. 866-994-6343. The controversy du jour is now if you like your plan, you can keep it. We haven't talked to you about that, I don't think. But let's listen to former President Bill Clinton. He spoke with Ozzy founder Carlos Watson about the Affordable Care Act on yesterday, explaining what President Obama should be willing to change about the law. Let's listen to the former president tell the current
third problem
president what to do.
Is for young people, mostly, but not all young, who are in the individual market whose incomes are above 400% of the poverty level. They were the ones who heard the promise, if you like what you got, you can keep it. I met a young man this week who has a family, 2 children, bought in the individual marketplace. His policy was canceled and one was substituted for it that doubled his premium. Now, I asked him, I said, same coverage? He said, yeah. And I said, but are your co-pays and deductibles the same? He said, no, they're much, much lower. So he said, in the years when I use health care, I might actually save money. But he said, you know, we're all young and we're all healthy. So I personally believe, even if it takes a change in the law, the president should honor the commitment the federal government made to those people and let them keep what they got.
What is that music from? Is that from
that
the clip?
Is weird. Is that you?
No, I thought it was like coming up on my computer. I was like,
no, that was must have been in the clip. He, you know, the former president requests dramatic music at the end of all of his statements.
I think he carries that with him and plays it whenever he says something that he thinks is worthy of note.
You guys just made the exact same joke. That's hilarious.
Yeah.
All right, so basically, you can explain this better than me, but my understanding is that now you've got the former president, you've got other Democrats now saying that President Obama should make good on his promise and allow those people to keep the programs, grandfather their policies, if you will. I don't think you think that's a good idea.
Well, there's two problems with it. One is it's not really workable because, again, it's insane to think that anyone ever had this ability that if you like your policy, you can keep it. They change insurance every frickin' year. You know, they change the premiums. They change what's in it. I work at a big university, and every year I have to make a new decision, and they keep phasing out my plan and putting in a new plan with different rules and different regulations, and it costs a different amount. And I'm, you know, this year I'm trying to run the numbers, and I'm completely thinking about changing my plan again because everything has changed in such a way that the numbers don't make sense to keep on the plan that we used to. This happens all the time. So even if they said, sure, keep it, The insurance companies can drop it anytime they want. I mean, they do. And so no one has the right and has ever had the right, with the exception of Medicare, of course, to say, hey, I want to keep this plan as it is forever, never change it, never do anything about it. That doesn't happen. So I don't even know how we mandate that, period. So part of it is that we've fallen into this trap of, you know, having this false belief that somehow anyone ever has been able to keep their policy if they like it, because that doesn't exist. But the second problem is, even if you wanted to say, sure, if the insurance companies want to keep it, everybody should get to do that, that will cost money. It'll cost a lot of money. Basically, we'll be giving subsidies or finding ways to pay for this for people outside the system. It will raise the cost of the bill. And to be quite honest with you, I don't care anymore. So if the way to make the country happy and finally accept a health care reform, which allows tens of millions of people potentially into the system and to get insurance and to try to improve access in the way that we've been trying to for decades, means that the bill has to cost billions of dollars more, and this is what America wants, fine, vote for it. You know, tell Congress to do it. But this idea somehow that President Obama has to fix this is a joke, because What is he going to do? Do you think Congress is going to pass? Do you think the Republicans are going to vote to pass to improve the Affordable Care Act? Feel free. Go ahead. You know, put your money where your mouth is. If the Republicans want to get together and do that, and the Democrats want to also do it, and President Obama wants to sign it, and we want to spend a couple $10 billion more in order to allow some people to keep insurance, which is either slightly cheap or something, fine. You know, at this point, everybody wants their piece of the pie. No one ever wants to be damaged by policy. That's fine. I know I'm being sarcastic here, but again, there was no way ever, I've been very consistent here, to reform the healthcare system in a way where 100% of the people do better immediately. Some people are going to take a short-term hit. Some people have been benefiting from the really, really, really crappy system that we have. Either they're young and healthy and only need a bare-bones plan, or, you know, insurance companies were preferentially only covering healthy people, so healthy people always made out like bandits. They, of course, don't need the healthcare system. And we were not doing well by the people that truly needed it. And we came up with a system which we thought was fairer, or some people thought was fairer, and was going to be more equitable and was going to wind up benefiting the vast majority of people. And even people who got sort of, you know, stuck in the short term had significant long term benefits, and that, hey, someday when you get sick, it's going to be okay because you're still going to be able to get health care. It's going to be cheap. Or if you have a kid and that kid is sick, everything's going to be okay because you're not going to lose your health care and you're going to be able to keep it forever, and you're going to get subsidies if you get poor, and it's all going to, you know, everything's going to be covered, and no one ever has to worry about the fact that they won't be uninsured at some point. So, but again, if they want to fix this in this way and they want to pay for it and they want to do it, I mean, I don't understand why anyone would fight it at this point. The thing is, though, I think this is more of a political battle than a reality, a policy battle, because I don't think the people who are screaming and yelling are actually willing to pay for the fix
We'll obviously be watching that play out. Mario in New Jersey, you're on the air. You're the first, second caller. on the air with Superman, Dr. Aaron Carroll here, the health policy expert, answering your questions as he always does. That's why.
Hi, guys. Good morning.
Hello, Mario.
So just to go off of what you guys are just saying, I think it would be if the Democrats want to make it interesting, they should say, okay, fine. If you want to keep your existing plan with all the benefits that Aaron just described, right, being able to have being in a risk pool with all healthy people or without any sick people, then you won't be able to benefit from the long term. So they want to get the short term benefits now, right? But I'm sure when they get sick, they'll be totally interested in the exchanges and how the Obamacare regulations work for them.
Well, so, people who don't get sick or don't need to access their health insurance or health care are generally far more indifferent about the issue, period.
I mean, that's right. It was like everybody's happy with their health insurance right up until the second they need it. I mean, this is the way it was right up until, you know, before the law as well.
Okay, so, guys, what I'm really calling about is the exchanges, Aaron.
Okay.
I'm glad. It's been 2 weeks. It's been too long. So, for a few questions, and bear with me.
Yeah, a lot of people are mad that you have been on the program for 2 weeks.
I apologize. I was traveling. I do apologize.
Just to make sure everybody knows it's Aaron, not me.
No. It was me. It was my fault. It just happened. I was traveling to give talks 2 weeks in a row on Wednesdays, and it was just too hard to figure this out. I apologize.
All right. So I know you don't like getting multiple questions at once. So let me
do one at a time. I'm happy to do them all, but if we could do one at a time, that'd be
one at a time. Okay. What percentage of
I do have other callers, you said.
I know.
Best.
Do them fast. These are good questions. You know that, Pete. You know me. So, right. What percentage of the premium increases in the individual market are due to the community ratings compared to providing the essential benefits?
So, if the premium increases that people are seeing, you have to remember that not everybody sees one. People who are, say, 40 or 50 are all seeing premium decreases.
No, I mean overall.
That's the problem is how do you calculate overall? Because in the individual market, there were significant numbers of people who couldn't get a policy at all. Basically, the cost was infinity. So, you know, the people who had premiums by far tended to be younger and healthier because they were the only ones that could get issued it. There was no guaranteed issue. So the average premium of those that were issued policies probably was lower, but that's because most people couldn't get them. That's the problem.
So you think most of it's from the community rating then?
That's the guaranteed issue. I think guaranteed issue actually has probably increased. I think guaranteed issue probably increased the cost somewhat. And when you couple that with the community ratings, yes, those are responsible for probably a good chunk of the increases that some people are seeing in premiums.
And do you think the prices that they've offered are conservative?
Well, no, I think the prices are—they're probably. Remember, these are insurance companies; they're probably going to be spot on. They can't go too low because they have to give the money back in terms of because they have the 85% medical loss ratio. So it's not as if they they pitched it too high and they took all this profit. They'd have to keep it. They want to go low enough that they compete. I think that the insurance companies want the market share, and they work their butts off to try to find what exactly the number they think that they need to clear their very low profit margin.
Okay, so I know there are reinsurance policies and risk corridors in the ACA to mitigate price increases due to an adverse pool.
Yep.
But can they just stop offering plans after the first year?
Theoretically, they can change, I think, every year. They can do whatever they like.
Can they take them out of the market altogether?
I think that those that do well will stick around and those that don't will readjust. I think that you have to remember insurance companies are very, very good at what they do. I mean, I talk to executives every once in a while. They didn't make these ideas, but they have been working hard to try to come up with numbers that they think are reasonable. They're very good at this. They have been operating many of them in markets.
When you say good at what they do, don't you mean good at making money?
Well, good at figuring out first of all, not all are good at making money. In fact, some lose money. But they're very, very good at figuring out ahead of time what do we think we need to charge people in order to sort of make everything work and try to bring home a little bit extra in profit. They have very good people working to crunch the numbers to figure out how do we do this, what's the amount that we need to charge, what do we need to do. This is what they do. And this is their entire business model. So it's not three guys in a room throwing darts at a board. They have massive infrastructure to try to figure this out. And it's a guess, and they're a little bit nervous because no one's ever done this before, and they want to see it work well. But they are working very hard to try to figure out what are the prices that they need to charge. They want to come in as low as possible to attract as much business without coming in so low that they put their sort of model at risk.
So David Frum was on the air a couple of days ago with Pete, and Pete unfortunately refused to push back when David Frum said that the medical loss ratio is a real problem because the private insurance companies without that medical loss ratio would be so efficient at keeping prices down.
It's the only time I push back. It's the only time I push back.
I don't think so. I mean, remember, some states have already had a medical loss ratio, so that this is not new policy for most insurance companies. They've dealt with this before. And the second thing is insurance companies operate on pretty thin profit margins. I mean, this is not like the pharmaceutical industry, which in some years has made like 16 or 17 or 18% of revenue in sale, or in profit of their revenue. That's not how insurance companies work. They're always sort of operating on the line. It's why year to year there are so many fluctuations in what they think they need to charge in premiums in order to make ends meet. The 85% medical loss ratio, remember, it means that 15% of the stuff can't go to health. That's not crazy. You know, that means that, like, they have to – you know, Medicare has always bragged for years that, like, 97% of what they spend goes to health. 85% of what the private insurance companies spend has got to go to health. Most insurance companies do fine with that. You know, not every insurance company was doing 20% in terms of what was not going to health. So, you know, this is another one of those where you know, how many times do you see insurance companies in the news these days screaming and yelling about the ACA, that it's got to be repealed, that it's got to go away, that's totally not fair? They don't do it so much. They have their heads down. They're figuring this out. They want this to work. This was the means by which health insurance reform could happen, and the private insurance industry gets to stick around and operate, for the most part, the way it used to. Most people still have the plans they did before. Medicaid didn't, you know, Medicaid got expanded, but not taken out a segment of the population that private insurance companies want to cover. Some states are even using private insurance for their Medicaid. Medicare didn't expand. It didn't drop below age 65. Tons of subsidies came out to let people buy more product to private insurance companies. They want this to work, and they are figuring out how to make this work. And when I hear pundits sort of come on and go, you know, woe is me, the insurance companies are getting squeezed, the insurance companies aren't saying that. They're not out. The medical device companies hate the tax. They're on TV all the time yelling and screaming about it. But the insurance companies, they're not complaining so much.
All right. Mario, you've had enough time.
Why are you never on TV? Well, that's TV. They gotta ask you on TV. I don't know. Maybe it's because I live in Indiana. It's possible.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you, Mario. Bob in Texas, and everybody should know that I just took off my socks. I'm looking at my bare feet. Go ahead, Bob.
Good morning. Hey, I got a little question for you. Don't you think that most people that are talking about being upset are upset because of the amount of increase that they're having in their premiums? The one factor that was never discussed before is they didn't expect to have it, and that they were okay with this Obamacare all the way up until it affected them individually.
Absolutely. I think, I do think it's human nature that everybody's fine with everything until it hits them. It's the same thing about we just said before, that everybody loves their health insurance right up until the moment they need it. You know, most people are okay with, you know, tax increases as long as it doesn't affect them. It is true. And granted, that's not a blanket statement. There are always people who are, you know, okay with stuff that does affect them or not okay with stuff that doesn't affect them. But that is human nature. It's important to remember that, you know, we're all watching this happen through the lens of the media. And I stopped a long time ago caring about what the media said or what they put on TV. And when I say that, I mean the news. Because they're working a narrative at this point. And the narrative is, look at all the people who are being screwed by the Affordable Care Act. At the same time, we should all remember that millions of people have signed up for Medicaid. I have seen none of them on the news. Millions of people who have not been able to get insurance and want to get insurance. You know, some of them are able to get insurance. Some of them are still trying to get insurance. Some of them are incredibly excited about the fact that they got insurance, which is far cheaper than they used to and is more comprehensive, and I have seen none of them on the news. And we're expecting, when all this is said and done, if they fix the website and everything goes, the tens of millions of people are going to wind up better than they are before, way more than people who will wind up worse than before, and none of them are making the news. So you're hearing multiple anecdotes, and they do constitute a reasonable number of people. It is in the millions of people who probably will see that they will have to be forced to buy plans which are more expensive and more comprehensive than they would like. Some of them will have to buy the exact same insurance that they had before, and it's going to cost more money because they were theoretically 30, had phenomenal jobs, which didn't buy them insurance, which makes them very rare, and they were able to get incredibly cheap policies because they were young, male, and healthy, and needed nothing else. Those policies only lasted a short period of time, but they had them, and now they're being forced to buy more comprehensive insurance. And so instead of costing, you know, a couple thousand, it's adding on $1,000 more. I mean, these things are going to happen. It's going
to
happen.
Go
ahead.
Yeah, but don't you think that's the part that is unfair of this whole law? I mean,
what does unfair mean? I mean, you know, people who make more money have to pay more taxes. Is that unfair? In some people's minds, yes. But some people will have to pay more than they did before, yes. But
all of this should have been brought out prior to the bill being signed.
What do you mean brought out? If you're listening to this show, nothing about what I'm saying now is any different than what I've been saying for 3-4 years on this radio show. It is exactly the same thing that people either chose to or did not. I can remember standing in Florida having a conversation years ago while I was on vacation with a caller who was very angry because his individual policy was going to have to go away. This was years ago, and I said, yeah, some people are going to get screwed. It is the nature of any policy change that some people will do better and some people will do worse. And we try to maximize the former and minimize the latter.
That's an unacceptable thought.
Well, policy which benefits everybody. There's nothing.
You should not have to make people. Some people suffer for other people.
Yeah, Hold on a second.
If somebody finds their policy going up $500 a month,
right?
Okay, they're going to have to make $800 to pay that five. Now, most people, just over the bracket from getting a subsidy to not getting a subsidy, can't afford that kind of increase. They can't afford it.
Well, okay, but if you're upset that the number's greater than zero, okay. But there is no policy in the universe which doesn't negatively affect someone. If they change a tax or a regulation or something, it affects somebody negatively, by definition, every single time. There is no policy which benefits. You could make that same argument about any tax increase, that people are going to have to adjust the way they live and change the way they do. That happens all the time. And again, we try to maximize the former and minimize the latter. There is no magic policy which blanketly affects it. And if you believe that when a politician says it, I'm sorry. But that's not true. There's nothing which can do that. There is no health care reform which do that. And remember the idea that if we go back to the way it was before, many, 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 many more people are going to be hurt than would be benefited. It's going to be the opposite. And why do we not seem to care about that as much? In other words, why do the millions of people who are benefiting significantly, you know, not get as much attention? And if you're that unhappy,
because those people, ask the caller that. I mean, the system was far more unfair before the Affordable Care Act than it is now. What do you think about that?
You know, it was only far more unfair because of the ideology that believes that everybody should be taken care of.
No, that's okay. Let's go with this. Everybody
in this country believes that.
Stop. You gotta let me talk. So
I gotta let you talk. You've been talking a mile a minute from the time I started.
Because I was answering your question. But
do you want to stay on the air or not? Go ahead, Aaron.
So, you know, if you make a lot of money and your insurance buys you a significant, let's say I work for IU and I'm in the top tax bracket, although I don't think I am, and I get an insurance policy which costs $20,000 a year, which is totally reasonable, because I work at a job, I get, say, about $6,000-$7,000 off of my insurance because it's taxed, I get a tax break. So I get to save I get a subsidy of $6,000-$7,000. If you, on the other hand, are self-employed and buy your own insurance in the individual market and can't buy it through your job, you don't get that subsidy of $6,000-$7,000. So your insurance, by definition, costs $6,000-$7,000 more than me. And if you make less than I do, it costs even more. So why do I get that benefit? Why is that fair, and why are you not upset by that?
Well, the reason you don't get that benefit is because you don't get the benefits of owning your own business.
Forget owning your own business. Let's say you have a job, and your job doesn't provide you insurance.
Own business, or you insure yourself.
Stop.
Your earning potentials are a direct result of your efforts.
Fine.
If you have a regular job,
I'll move it. I'll change it. You work for a job. They don't provide you insurance. You work for the exact same size company, exact same job, but they don't provide you insurance, and you have to buy it yourself. You don't get the tax break.
That's correct.
But, so you pay $67,000 more than I do.
I'm afraid of is 1 year from now when the company is
no, but answer what he just said. What about
fair?
That person?
Why are you
why
not
is that fair?
Concerned? Why don't you care about that?
Because
guy?
I'll tell you why. Because I'm gonna insinuate that the caller Bob in Texas thinks that person that doesn't own their own business and doesn't work at a university like you do doesn't deserve it because they should own their own business. They shouldn't be just a working stiff. They should try harder. But that's what I'm insinuating. I'll of course let Bob answer himself.
Hey, look, I'm a working stiff. Matter of fact, I'm sitting on the side of a dirt road in my truck right now having a conversation with
you. Not arguing that. Why do you not care that person is – we work in the same job, same company, same exact sector, same exact type of thing, but I get insurance through my job and it costs $6,000 less than somebody who doesn't get insurance for his job and has to buy it for himself. Why are you not concerned about that guy getting screwed?
It's not that guy is getting screwed. It's just that
his insurance costs $6,000 to $7,000 more.
Part of my pay is the money that my company donates to me for my.
Why do you get the tax break and that other guy doesn't? Why should he get $6,000 in a huge tax giveaway that the other guy doesn't get when nothing about their lives is different?
Well, how do
why
I
are we
get
not outraged?
$6,000 tax break working for a company.
What? Because that's how the law is. That's how the law works. If my job pays for my insurance, it costs $6,000 less for me than if my job doesn't.
That's not somebody. You know, that's a benefit I get out of my hourly.
That's tax law. That's not the job doing it for you. That's how the law of the United States is structured. I get a benefit. The other guy gets screwed. That's not the company. That's the law. So tell me why
that's
fair.
That's not true.
All right.
Well, fight's over. Done. It's over. Winner, Aaron Carroll. You can't say it's not.
Win or lose. I just want someone to.
Well,
tell me
I mean, listen. If you get to the guy was being is trying to be reasonable. It's a great argument. You just enlightened so many people, which is why I let it go on so far. When someone says that it's not true. Then it's over. I'm sorry that I say winning, losing. It's not about winning, losing. But you can't say that something isn't that is. Then we're done. Then I have to move on and take a break in this case and go back to other callers. Because that's when he was being reasonable and bringing up concerns that a lot of people have. But when you were presenting a fact about tax law and he said it's not true, it's my job as moderating this conversation. But okay, let's move on then.
Yeah.
Right?
Is that
fair?
I do think that's reasonable. But it's so important for people to recognize that the way that the United States is structured right now, people who get, you know, the 60 or some percent that get their employee insurance through their jobs are getting a massive subsidy. Massive subsidy. I mean, Ted Cruz, Austin made a huge amount of news a couple weeks ago because Ted Cruz, his press secretary, got up and said, you know, he doesn't believe in this. He won't accept a government handout to buy his insurance because it was the exchanges and stuff. And Austin went on a tear just on his wife's policy. It looks like it costs $40,000 a year. Their tax break is massive. The subsidy that they get from the government, because of course they're in the way high tax bracket, you know, tens of thousands of dollars in quote unquote tax breaks that they get for buying their insurance that Americans who don't get insurance, their jobs do not get. And somehow that's fine. And we don't care that huge numbers of people are being screwed by the fact that the tax benefits one group and not the other. But somehow now that we have a new law where some people benefit and some people don't, that's the end of it.
Well, what's really convincing in the argument that you just made and that people don't quite understand tax law and the subsidies that employers get, but is the idea of work. An equivalent hard work. And let's say someone, it's the idea of being getting your insurance through your employer or on the individual market. If you take both of those people and say they work equally as hard and they're equal for all other reasons, but one guy works, gets their insurance through the individual market and one guy or woman doesn't, that's what that debate just watered down to me.
Right.
And if you can't really objectively decide that the person that doesn't get their insurance through their employer but works just as hard, if not maybe harder, and maybe even created their own business and took a ton more risks than the guy who works for SiriusXM in this case or Indiana University in this case, then I don't know what to tell you.
Well, see, and the quickest way to fix this, this is the reason, by by the way, people who make above 400% of the poverty line are getting screwed. It's because they're the one group that's not getting any kind of tax break or subsidy. The quickest way to fix this would be to either eliminate the tax break for people who get insurance for their jobs, which would, by the way, bring in hundreds of millions, billions of dollars of revenue. But everybody would hate that. Or extend that tax break to everybody. Say no matter where you get your insurance, the money you pay would be tax deductible, which, by the way, was what John McCain wanted to do back when he was president. But he also wanted to uncouple it from insurance from employment entirely, which was radical.
When he was running,
running for president. We're talking a long time ago. But you'll give the tax break to everybody, in which case everybody's insurance will go down. The more money you make, the larger your tax break because deductions are worth more. And so everyone would be happy. The problem there is that it costs tons of money. And nobody wants to spend any money. So you see a lot of people arguing for the status quo or the status quo ante where, hey, they're getting a massive tax break the vast majority of the time, but other suckers aren't, and they just want to keep that in place.
All right. My guest is Aaron Carroll. He's on Twitter, at Aaron E. Carroll. If you're not following him now and after that conversation with Bob from Texas, you're missing out. And he blogs at The Incidental Economist. And when he comes back, I'm going to do more of what I've been doing, stay out of the conversation, let him host the program and take your calls. Give us a call, join the conversation, be a part of it, 866-994-6343, experts on issues. This guy knows more and is able to spout it out than almost anybody you can find, and that's why we love having him on. That's why you love calling him and challenging him in this case, in the last case. We'll be right back after a quick break.
Stand up with Pete Dominic. You're listening to a radio bumper for a show. Now some music, then talking.
David in Indiana, you're on with at Aaron E. Carroll. Go ahead, David.
Hey, guys. First of all, I appreciate everything both of you do. Really learn a lot listening to these segments. I had sort of a broader question about Medicaid that was inspired by Dr. Carroll's post yesterday responding to a Medicaid reform proposal.
Yes.
His post at the Incidental Economist blog, theincidentaleconomist.com,
right,
for all your health policy information. Go ahead.
Well, the point that you seemed to make towards the end there, Dr. Carroll, was that in all these proposals – we seem to be, trying to reinvent the wheel, so to speak. I know from having read you before that if you want to do a program like Medicaid, that it's difficult to structure it in a way that is that would make it any cheaper without substantially affecting the amount of people that could use it.
Yep.
But the one thing I want to ask you about in terms of evidence is, these proposals seem to have a sort of very practical argument that being on Medicaid actually harms people or is
yeah,
worse than having no insurance whatsoever. Right. I was wondering if you could briefly summarize what we know from the evidence on that.
That debate has been very interesting to watch play out.
The thing that drives me crazy is that that debate doesn't move forward. And so when I say that, what I mean is that there are certain people who have made quite a bit of hay and a good living out of making claims that Medicaid harms people or hurts people. And whenever they make a post or they make a statement, someone like me will respond with an actual argument and evidence saying, well, this is why that's a mistake. And what they do then is ignore what I say and just keep saying what they say over and over again. So we cannot move it forward. So I continue to respond, and other people often don't. So the major arguments against that is there are a couple studies out there which are not really randomized controlled trials to prove causality, but they are association studies or correlation studies where they show that people who are on Medicaid often have worse outcomes than people who don't have Medicaid, and they just leave it at that. And they say, therefore, Medicaid harms people, or Medicaid is worse than having no insurance. The problem with any study like that is that, by definition, people who are on Medicaid are way, way, way poorer than people who don't get Medicaid because they're too rich to qualify for Medicaid, in which case you're not seeing that Medicaid is associated with people who don't do well. It's the fact that poor people don't do as well as richer people, period. And so that has been shown again and again and again. It is not that if we take super poor people and we give half of them Medicaid and we give half of them nothing, the Medicaid people don't do as well. That's ridiculous. And in fact, there have been lots of studies that show that's not the case at all. And when you try to tease out these differences and account for things like socioeconomic status and where do you live and what was your health like before you got your Medicaid and all these other things, there's no truth at all to the idea that Medicaid is worse than having no insurance. And let's pause and think about that for a second. How can you construct a reasonable argument in your head that would say that somebody with Medicaid, which, by the way, is optional, you can refuse it, would be worse off than somebody with no help to pay their medical bills at all? It also assumes that people are so stupid, especially poor people, that they would continue to accept a product which is harming their health when all they would have to do is say no, and that they would be magically more benefit, and they would be magically doing better. There's nothing to this. If you want, you know, you can search on the blog. I wrote a piece with a couple other economists in the New England Journal of Medicine, like, I think it was like 2 years ago, which summarizes and pretty much takes apart all of the arguments against this idea that Medicaid is bad for health or that Medicaid harms people. It's just search my name in New England Journal of Medicine, and it will come up. And it's two pages. It's not a long read. But, you know, this doesn't make common sense. I mean, it's just like, how can it be that giving people some assistance is somehow worse than nothing? It's a bizarre argument that, you know, goes on a trick of just some bad or flawed research and then tries to carry it out. And if you can find people who continue to hold this argument, who will be willing to respond to what I just said and come up with better constructed arguments as to why having Medicaid would be worse than having no insurance at all, I am more than happy to continue to sort of talk about it or to counter that evidence. But it doesn't make sense theoretically or empirically.
David, thank you very much. I appreciate it. Frank in Pennsylvania, you're on with Dr. Aaron Carroll. At Aaron E. Carroll, theincidentaleconomist.com is the blog. Go ahead, Frank.
Good morning.
Morning.
This whole argument is really nonsensical, and it's more like goulash from the government with this health care. They give us, the people, something to bite on, which isn't going to help us. As long as that word insurance is tacked on to health care, we're never going to correct this problem, because as long as the private market can say, and you can go on the Affordable Health Care Exchange site right now, and you can get different levels of coverage. This is nonsensical, okay?
Well, you say there's a problem. Can we be specific? I
don't know. I don't know what you're talking about.
Which problem are you talking about? Because there's many problems.
You said this whole argument. In this conversation alone, we've been.
I need you to be more specific. I don't know what argument you're talking about and what problem it's attacking.
Well, this whole health care, okay, this whole health care problem in America is being handled by the private industry, saying if you have more money, okay, you should get a tax break, or you shouldn't get a tax break. You can buy higher levels of coverage if you're able to buy higher levels of coverage. I break my leg. You break your leg. You should be able to go get your leg fixed. I get cancer. You get cancer. It doesn't matter if I'm a CEO of a company or I'm a ditch digger. Or a garbage truck, on the back of the garbage truck. The worst thing in America anywhere is being sick, all right? You can lose everything you've acquired in life, all right? And that may be devastating, but the worst thing in America is being sick. And I'm talking about
The worst thing in America, the worst thing in the world is not being sick. The worst thing in the world is having your child be sick. That's far worse.
They're both terrible. What do you think will be better?
The way it's going to be better is socialized medicine. All right.
I mean, there's a reasonable argument to be made that I think that, you know, a socialized system has the potential to cost less right off the bat. Certainly would get us universal coverage. There are people who would argue about how it would work in America. But I always come back to the same problem of there's no votes for that. You know, there's no political. Well, and I'm not saying that as a defeatist attitude. I'm saying that in the sense that, like, people who feel strongly about this need to find ways to get congressmen and senators to support that. There's one senator, one, who supports, you know, single payer system. It's Bernie Sanders. He's, you know, he's in Vermont. There, that's it. That is 100% of the support for this in the Senate. That's not a ding against the single payer movement. It's not a ding against the quality of single payer systems in the United States. It's a practical reality of the political way that America sits today. And so if there was a single payer, you know, up for a vote right now, I wouldn't fight it. I think that that's another viable way to reform the healthcare system. But I think refusing any steps forward because single payer would be better means that nothing is ever going to happen.
I appreciate the passion of the caller, Frank, and I also appreciate Dr. Carroll's response, which is, you know, politics and what is possible.
I hate politics. Wish the world was different. It's not.
Norman in Texas is on the air. Norman.
Hey, good morning. Can you
hear
me,
Norman? Yeah, you're on. Go ahead, loud and clear.
Yeah, I'm retired military, and we have TRICARE, and in TRICARE, there's two different types. The types where you don't pay any premium, and your copay for your prescriptions and doctor visits are a little bit higher.
Yep.
Then they have the other version where you actually have to pay a premium, but the premiums that we pay for myself and my wife are something like $700 a year. And when I hear that these people are paying $700 a month,
yeah, I do.
I had no idea that health care was that expensive in terms of insurance.
Now, I pay that much a month for my family-based insurance plan with my employers playing a significant part of it. Insurance is ridiculously expensive in the United States. The average family average, by the way, the average family-based employer-provided health plan in the United States is about $16,000 a year, which means it's way over $1,000 a month. The average individual plan is approaching like $6,000 a month. That's just for a single person. That's the average, not the high end. The average.
And by the way, the VA where he has gotten his care is a socialized system where it's
completely.
I don't go to the VA. I've never been to a VA. With TRICARE, you don't go to the VA or necessarily to a base that has a hospital on the base.
No, insurance is ridiculously expensive in the United States. It's massively, massively expensive. No one should be under the illusion that it is going to be cheap or free.
Let me ask you this.
I'm out of time. I hate to cut you off, Norman. And I literally, right before you said that, he said you've got 45 seconds. So I've got to wrap it up. But I really appreciate the call, all the calls. And Dr. Carroll, our biggest fan and listener and supporter is a woman named Tina Winsett. She says it's worth having that SiriusXM subscription just to hear an hour each week of Dr. Aaron Carroll on Pete Dominic's show. Invaluable information, especially on the Affordable Care Act. Thank you, as always, for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Follow Dr. Carroll on Twitter, at Aaron E. Carroll, 2 R's, 2 L's. You can read his blog at The Incidental Economist. You can email him. A lot of times he'll get back to you. And you can watch his new YouTube videos that he does every week with YouTube star John Green. That's it for us. If you're listening on the replay, stay tuned for a fun first hour. Talk to Barry Ritholtz. We talked about spirituality in the second hour. And, of course, Dr. Carroll for the third hour. If you're listening on the replay, stay tuned for Covino and Rich. And everybody, be the change that you want to see in the world. Think for yourself. If I said it, don't believe me. Look it up. I'm not the teacher. I'm just one of your classmates. Thank you, Alfred, Chris, Melanie, and our interns, Tim and Jessica. We'll talk to you right here tomorrow. That's up.